Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This is The Guardian.
The sin was to promise cheaper power before the last election. And just to go out there and say, this is great, everyone gets a pony, is just as dishonest as denying the science or having a confected fear campaign around attacks. Like, the real discussion that leadership involves is saying, this is really hard. Not that this is easy, but this is hard.
Hello, I'm Paul Karp, Chief Political Correspondent at Guardian Australia, coming to you from the lands of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri peoples. It's our regular essential special on the Australian Politics Podcast, which means I'm here with Peter Lewis, the Executive Director of Essential Media. Hello, Peter, how are you?
I'm well, Paul.
Thanks for joining me. So, following Anthony Albanese's announcement of a new green industry plan, the latest Guardian Essential poll asked voters if they think the transition to renewable energy is going to be an easy one. But before we talk about renewables and how people feel about Made in Australia, how about we start with the leaders' ratings? What do people think of Anthony Albanese and Peter Dutton this fortnight?
Look, the big movement, and we do check in on the approval or disapproval of the jobs each are doing in the job they have. So this is not preferred Prime Minister. This is approval of the job that the Prime Minister is doing as Prime Minister and the job that Peter Dutton is doing as opposition leader. It's actually a blue letter day for Dutton in that it's the first time that his approvals has been higher than his disapprovals. 44, 41... with 15% don't know, plus 3 in contrast, and no big changes here, but the disapproval for Anthony Albanese is above the approval, 48, 43, so he's net negative 5. So the big shift in attitudes was really around, I think, initially the interest rate rises, and now they've kind of leveled out. The rise with Dutton has been kind of consistent since October. It's sort of been going up a couple of points each time we check in, which is every couple of months.
And it's a net 7-point turnaround with his approval up 4 points and his disapproval down 3 points. Is there any sense of who these people are that approve of Dutton more?
Look, he's solidifying his support amongst coalition voters. He is up to strong approve, 22-53 approve of coalition. Minor parties, independents, it's not so strong. Greens, unsurprisingly low, and Labor low. Unsurprisingly, he has approvals that are reasonably strong with over 55s and less support with younger. You know, the reality is if this was a nation of over 55s, we'd have a pretty strong majority of a Liberal government and vice versa. If only under 35s were voting, it would be a progressive coalition. So the only other thing I'll note is that Dutton is at 49 either approve or strongly approve amongst blokes, and that's 10 points more than females. So there is, I think we'd say, an older bloke vibe going in behind him. But, you know, I don't want to trivialise this because I think one of the stories that has been going in under the radar over the last 6 to 12 months is that I think a lot of people on the progressive side of politics thought this guy was an easy beat. He was so creepy and weird looking and negative and ideological that he would be unelectable. Like, there have been previous politicians that have said him before that have had those traits and have become very successful opposition leaders, so successful they become prime ministers. So I just think the numbers are a good wake-up call for progressives who might naturally recoil at some of the ways he's portrayed in the galleries he's playing to, but he's doing well for an opposition leader with those numbers.
Yes, and you've been very consistent in making that warning. It's not the first time that you've pointed out that it would be very foolish to count out a political animal like Peter Dutton. In your column this week, you argued that the other thing that's not going to be a cakewalk is selling this energy transition. So let's move on to talk about that. First up, did people think that the transition from fossil fuels to renewable energy would be positive, negative, or have no impact on Australia, on their community, and on them individually?
Yeah, so look, glass half full. More people think that a renewable energy transition will be positive than negative, but in none of those three categories, Australia as a whole, my community, or me individually, is it a majority. So Australia as a whole, 49-26 with 25% undecided. My community, 42 positive, 25 negative. And I want to come back to that in a sec, Paul. And then 36-23 me individually. Now, there's two things going on there. One is that there is a big shift between people that are lived in inner metro and rural. So my community benefiting, 53% of people who are in inner metro agree with that, just 34% of rural. Me individually, it's 47-26. Now, I think a lot of the renewable polling that we've seen over the last 12 to 18 months gives us this sort of number of 65% say they're basically on board with renewables. And I've been thinking about this a lot, and we've been running quite a few focus groups for various folk around this as well. And it really has a bit of a voice vibe to me at the moment, in that we kept getting in our quant at the beginning of the voice campaign this 65% number, and everyone thought, oh, this is going to be fine. But once you started unpacking it, you realised that the support was quite brittle. And I think particularly in rural areas, there's a real incentive for the Nats to turn this into a political contest because those are seats they want to hold on to. And there are some, particularly up the coast of New South Wales, where they see potential pickup. So it's kind of a be alert, not alarmed. But I do think that more work needs to be done in explaining what the renewable transition actually is, and a real honest discussion, as I say in my column this week, that it's hard. Like, to fundamentally change the energy base of a nation is not something that's done with a slogan or a new law. It is like decades of hard work that involves big industrial investment. It involves disruption through the creation of effectively a new energy grid being fed by new inputs. So we're shifting from a fossil fuel base to wind, sun, hydro, underscored in the long term with battery technology. But all that technology is new and needs to be funded and developed. And you wouldn't be doing this if you didn't have to, but because of the challenge of global warming, it is something that the whole world is confronting. And so Australia needs to be doing it. Now, the good news out of all of that is that I think the government is recognising that. And I think in a way, the way to read the speech and the kind of foreshadowing that the budget's going to be based around this future made in Australia is that for probably the first time, I'm seeing the government recognising they've got to sell the hard work and not just the sound grabs. I observe in this week's column that most of the messaging that has been coming out of the government has either been this horrible, torpid technocracy that says, you know, it's either a target, an acronym, or a megawatt hour. So that's one bit of communication coming out of the government. And the other is this kind of schmaltzy, cheaper, cleaner, better future, yay, with lots of exclamation marks. And neither of those are really an honest characterisation of what's involved. And so I think a lot of what we'll go through today is just sort of looking at what's happening underneath that and the work the government needs to do to build the social licence for this really, really big change.
Because if you start at the general level, Australia as a whole, 49% said it will be positive for that. Then come down to my community, 42, and then down to the particular, to the individual, me individually, only 36%. And sadly, you know, voters are often thinking about themselves when they cast their vote rather than at the higher, more general level. So that is the challenge for selling it.
Indeed, and particularly at a time when, you know, it's almost becoming a trope, cost of living crisis. But when people are under financial stress, and our polling keeps showing that more than a majority of people say they're struggling, people will be sort of voting more on their material needs than more extrinsic values. So, yeah, there is a real challenge there. But it's also, if the government can't do it, you wonder what they're there for, because it is the big project. And again, I don't want to catastrophise where the government is, because I think, you know, that speech was the beginning of a reset on this, where it's about what are we going to build and how is that going to work? And there is a different conversation that comes out of that. And as we'll see as we go through some of the numbers, new constituencies that are open to some of those messages as well.
Well, let's jump ahead then to what people thought of the Future Made in Australia policy. You told respondents that this would provide funding for large-scale renewable energy projects that support the creation of local jobs. What did people say about whether or not they supported such a policy?
This is always the problem in reducing something that's basically a fairly detailed and substantial speech into a question like this. And, you know, clearly there's a lot of people in the middle who don't really engage. But it's 51 support, 18% opposition to that top-level proposition. I think the most interesting thing in these numbers is that Green voters at 68, with basically no one opposing, are even more enthusiastic than Labor voters at 55%. But you've also got 43% of Coalition voters and 46% of independents liking what they're hearing. Now, I think that opens up a really interesting point, that if this is the climate play, you're actually running something that the Greens, well, Green supporters, and you would imagine the Greens reflecting that, will lean in behind you rather than some of the other climate points of friction, such as even more ambitious targets, although we'll get to that in a sec. People don't think we're going to meet the current ones, or the, you know, specifics around the transition away from fossil fuels. But this is a program that you feel like the broad progressive alliance and a fair crack of the coalition will lean into. 30% neutral, I think that's around not yet engaging in these discussions. Because I know you wrote about it over the last couple of weeks. This is actually, what he's proposing is a different way of looking at the role government plays, much more back to that idea of investing behind specific industries and clearly reacting to some of the big investments that have been occurring in the US and Europe and parts of Asia as well. So it is a bit of a different game.
A lot of the discourse after the speech is like, oh, government is picking winners again. And it's, you know, I studied Year 12 economics before the GFC, and then it was, you know, still in the end of history type period, where there was a neoliberal, neoclassical consensus since the 1980s that we don't do industry policy anymore. Mm. But then you drill down and you ask people some questions that go to their underlying view about whether or not the government should have a role in the economy. And what did you find? You found people were actually quite red hot on industry policy.
Well, the one that I love is that 64% of people agree it was a mistake to allow the Australian car industry to close, which people remember Joe Hockey famously basically said go goodbye when he was treasurer, because he was just sick of government putting money into them when he couldn't get his austerity budget through. 70% agreeing the pandemic shows we cannot be wholly reliant on global supply chains. And then some of the defence statements, the market will make the best decisions and governments should stay out of the way. Only 34% sign up to that. It's not the government's job to support Australian businesses that can't compete overseas. Only 37% sign up to that. Now, the negatives don't outweigh that. They're in the mid to high 20s, with a lot of people not putting a position, but the one that really stood out to me here was on those sort of economic, I won't call them economic nationalism, but more that government intervention. It's the over 55s that on most measures are just leaning in behind the coalition. 79% of those agree the pandemic showed we cannot wholly rely on global supply chains. 75% of those older voters agree it was a mistake to allow the Australian car industry to close.
This is what you mean by new constituencies. Labor's doing badly with the over 55s, but the over 55s are the ones that are most responsive to this build it here mentality.
Exactly. They have lived in a time when government did take more active roles. The younger people are more likely to say don't know, but there is a clear... There was a clear certainty amongst the vast majority of older voters that this notion that government should just be, you know, stripping away all the regulation and just letting the market do its business, like it, you look at those numbers and you say it's a failed project. And it is the first time I think, I don't think, and you might correct me, I think in the last Labor government there was that kind of the Kim Il-Car car plan. Like there was a little bit of government intervention on a few things, but that was more trying to find ways of keeping existing industries going. But, you know, if you're going to pick a winner, surely you pick the winner that's going to allow you to make the transition to save the planet. Like, you know, I don't think it's like you're tossing up whether we should build mobile phones or, you know, Lego blocks. Like this is actually the game. And so other governments are recognising that. It's almost like it's another black swan event. So pandemic changed the way we thought about government in terms of public health measures and supporting people. Maybe this, the need for an energy transition is the moment that we start rethinking the orthodoxy that right, it goes back to when you were at uni and I was a young journalist, which was that there is no role for government except to fade into the background.
Arrayed against Labor's Made in Australia policy, which is very renewables heavy, is the coalition's nuclear fantasy, which had a bit of a setback this fortnight because Peter Dutton had to admit they're not going to be releasing a policy on this side of the budget, kicking that can down the road. But what did you find in terms of whether Australians supported developing nuclear power plants to generate electricity?
So there is majority support. It almost mirrors support for made them here or whatever we're calling it, the future Made in Australia policy. 52% support, 31% oppose, 17% unsure. Again, slightly older skew, 55% support, but also 53% younger. It's kind of the mid. I still like to think of myself as 35 to 54. I'm a proud Gen X. I squeeze into the over 55 now, but I was one of those people that was politicised during the Cold War around nuclear, and I find it a really difficult issue to sort of enter with any thought that we could be mislearning the lessons from our past. But there is majority support. He's got something to work with here, particularly with the disruption of renewables. So if you look at those numbers where, particularly in those regional areas where the renewable infrastructure is going to be built out, the idea that you could do it in another way that isn't going to interrupt your shoreline or your back paddock has obvious appeal. The proposition has not had its feet held to the fire around cost or viability or timeframes, but the idea that there is an alternate technology, like, you know, whenever you poll on three things, if there is a middle ground, people tend to gravitate. So if you've got fossil fuels, you've got sun and wind, and you've got this other thing that other parts of the world are using as part of their transition, like there is an unsurprising settling of opinion in there. And just to ask myself the next question, that is reinforced when you ask people around cost, right? So the other key benchmark we were asking this time was around what people think is the cheapest source of energy. And we asked it in terms of cost, including infrastructure and household price. The most expensive people find is renewables at 40%, nuclear at 36%, fossil fuels and gas at 24%. So the public narrative is still that renewable energies are more expensive to build. And I think part of that is linked to the lived experience that as the renewable grid rolls out, prices are going up and we know that's for other reasons.
Mm-hmm. Correlation, not causation.
Indeed. But if we just go out, or people advocating for renewables just go out and say, cheaper, cleaner, like, you lose them at hello. You've got to do the work to explain why a grid that's powered by free sources like sun, wind and water is going to be the long-term cheaper, and the work just hasn't been done.
Well, I think that it's an easy line for the coalition to say you were promised $275 cut to power prices by 2025, but it's true to say that power prices would be even higher if we weren't bringing all these renewables online, because the marginal cost is cheaper. It's just that it is happening at the same time that fossil fuel prices are spiking. And if you look at what is actually involved in nuclear, which is to extend the life of coal power plants, it's no solution at all, really.
So that is the political challenge, though, because in a way the sin was to promise cheaper power before the last election. And I do say in this week's column, just to go out there and say this is great, everyone gets a pony, is just as dishonest as denying the science or having a confected fear campaign around attacks. Like, the real discussion that leadership involves is saying this is really hard. Not that this is easy, but this is hard. Mazzucato, who's this sort of global sort of policy rock star, was out talking to a lot of the Labor cabinet about moonshots the other week. And this is her idea that you organise economies and societies around big, ambitious projects, not because they're easy, but because they're hard, which was that famous JFK quote when he announced the space race. Now, I don't have the answer to this, but I just have an inkling that there needs to be a recast, that every time you're talking about renewable, you promise something that's great. It just, I think people smell a rat. They know it's hard. They can see it's hard. And maybe it's time for a bit of honesty around that.
Well, let's turn to the reason that we're doing the energy transition, which is to avoid catastrophic global heating.
Oh, that.
You asked people, the Albanese government committed to reaching net zero emissions by 2050. Did people think we were going to make it?
No. So two things here. One is that the whole idea of basing a policy around targets is the conversation starter. It's the entree. It's not the main course. The main course is actually building the stuff. But even in terms of the entree, we've got 38% of people saying it's likely we're going to meet this target, 50% saying it's not. That's improved a little bit since we asked it last, towards the end of last year, where it was 31 very likely and 57% very unlikely. So there's been about an 8-10 point shift around. I'm just seeing if there's any standouts here. Regional, less likely to think they're going to reach the target. And I'll just have a look at age. Yeah. Older people, much more likely to think we won't reach the target. The young, God love them, think we're going to get there anyway. 54% think we're going to make it, as opposed to just 23% of us older folk.
So are people just a little calmer because we have a government with an ambitious target, or what do you think's going on?
I think they're seeing stuff being done. Like, there's no doubt that things are happening, right? And we in the city don't see it as much as folk in the country. Like, there are big areas where there are being big solar farms being built. There are the start of big long-term discussions about the big offshore wind and onshore wind, which is actually going to build the capacity to sort of drive the transition. One in three homes now have rooftop solar. We're talking about bringing EVs into the grid. So it's all kind of happening. And it's gone, I think, from being this hypothetical argument about, are we going to go? Are we going to do it? We're actually on the journey now. And it's just, I think, a little bit more honesty about what's involved in that journey will, I think, open up new possibilities, as we saw the other week with the Future Made in Australia, to change talking about the way we address this big challenge. Because I think most people that bought a climate T-shirt back in the early 2000s, it's kind of fully moth-ridden now and it probably doesn't fit. I know mine doesn't anymore.
Hmm. So to sum up, we need more honesty, and it's going to take hard work selling the energy transition, but Made in Australia is not bad as a badge for what they're trying to achieve.
I think it's definitely better than what we've been getting over the last 18 months to 2 years. So, more power to their pen. It's just now putting that into practice, because the longer you let this stuff drift, I think the more it's hard to bring it back. One final thought, you know, and we get this all the time. The other challenge with all this is that we've got a time of really low trust in government, low trust in the businesses which are driving the investment, and low trust in most sources of information. So that is the gumbo where this conversation is trying to be had through, and it just creates a higher degree of difficulty and I think a perverse incentive to dumb things down rather than to treat people intelligently. But, you know, it's a low bar. It can only rise.
Well, I look forward to seeing you here every fortnight between now and 2050, Peter. Hopefully Canberra is not waterfront by then. Thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure, Paul.
This episode was produced by Miles Herbert, Alison Chan and Karishma Luthria. The executive producer was Miles Martignoni, and I'm Paul Karp. We'll have another episode of Australian Politics on Saturday. Thanks for listening and see you next time.
How can a people-first approach to higher education transformation improve success? An EY report suggests that taking emotional and psychological factors into account is just as important as the technology. Six factors drive this human-centered approach: leadership, inspiration, care, empowerment, investment, and collaboration. Get these right, and they can more than double an organization's chance of transformation success. Learn more about people-first transformation at theguardian.com/transforminghighereducation. This message was paid for by EY.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.